This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. With another 60 minutes of radio drama, this is the Relic Radio Show. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me again this Tuesday. We'll begin this week with Radio City Playhouse and their episode from February 28th, 1949, titled Deadline. Then we'll hear from Believe It or Not. Close off the show today with Behind the Mic. This episode's from November 3rd, 1940. It's titled Sound Effects. But first, here's Deadline from the Radio City Playhouse.
This is Radio City Playhouse. Ladies and gentlemen, here is the director of Radio City Playhouse, Harry W. Junkin.
Thank you, Bob Warren. Friends, this week we are honored to present a young author new to Radio City Playhouse, Mr. John Bethune, B-E-T-H-U-N-E, Bethune. It is a name we think you will do well to watch, because for brittle and penetrating radio writing, Mr. Bethune is in a class by himself. We hope to present more of his work in the very near future. The name of our play is Deadline, and stars Claudia Morgan as Marcia Robbins, Paul Nugent as Benson Todd, and Bernard Grant as Jerry. Deadline by John Bethune, Attraction 27 on Radio City Playhouse.
Hello, Sphinx Club. Can I speak to Louis in the bar, please? Oh, what's he doing? Hello, Louis. This is Marcia Robbins. Marcia Robbins, Benson Todd's secretary. Yes. Listen, has Mr. Todd been in tonight? Well, if he comes in during the next half hour, will you tell him I called? Louis, it's very important. I think he's forgotten or something, and it's very urgent that I get hold of him. All right. Thanks. Goodbye. That's the way the story began. Me chasing Benson Todd all over town. Perhaps you wonder why I don't write a book about Benson Todd. Well, it's a fair enough question. A book dealing with one of our more outrageous drama critics would be bound to have a certain celebrity value, if nothing else. And as a study in advanced megalomania, it might even have a certain clinical value. But unfortunately, it's not quite as simple as that. In the first place, having spent 5 hair-raising years as Benson Todd's personal secretary, I find it rather difficult to view him with the proper detachment and reverence of a good biographer. I wouldn't dare write a book about him, fictional or otherwise. However, there is one rather illuminating episode in the saga of Benson Todd, which I think I can safely repeat. It happened only last season, on that now famous evening when the Vaughan Courtney production of Macbeth opened on Broadway. Perhaps you remember, it was at the Gotham Theater.
Will it not be received when we have marked with blood those sleepy two of his own chamber and used their very daggers that they have done it?
Who dares receive it other, as we shall make our griefs and clamor roar upon his death?
I am settled, and bend up each corporal agent to this terrible feat. Away, and mock the time with fairest show. False face must hide what the false heart doth know.
Thank you. Little things, Ed.
I'll give you odds it doesn't run away.
Well, someone gave Reg some tickets, and we've seen everything else.
But didn't you love the dirty old ladies with beards?
He may be hot stuff in the movies, but on the stage, oh, brother.
But you must admit he's beautiful.
What happens in the second act?
Darling, do you think we can bear another act?
Good thing Shakespeare never lived to see it.
I can't wait to read the critics.
Oh, there goes one of them now.
Oh, where?
Benson Todd, just going out the door.
Oh, the one with the inscrutable look.
Benson Todd, eh? Boy, I'll bet he gives it a roasting.
Brother, you can say that again.
Mr. Todd, wait a minute, please. Excuse me, please. Pardon me, please. Mr. Todd!
Do you happen by any chance to be speaking to me?
Yes, I am. I saw you leaving the theater, and I wanted to have a word with you.
What about?
Well, I don't blame you for leaving, Mr. Todd.
One act of this thing is plenty.
Mr. Todd, I'm Mrs. Vaughn Courtney.
Really?
Well, I don't blame you for leaving, Mr. Todd.
You said that once.
But I just wanted to explain.
Just a moment, Mrs. Courtney. Did your husband notice my leaving? Did he send you out to waylay me and ask me to...
Of course he didn't notice you leaving, and he'd be furious if he knew that I was...
Then I suggest you go back into the theater before he finds out you're asking me to change my opinion of his performance.
I wouldn't think of asking you to alter your opinion, Mr. Todd. I know quite well that Vaughn is inadequate tonight.
Inadequate? My dear Mrs. Courtney, your husband's acting this evening is inexcusable.
Oh, no, not altogether. That's why I followed you out. You see, Mr. Todd, for the past few days, Vaughn hasn't been at all well. In fact, his doctor ordered him not to go on tonight.
Then why did he?
Oh, well, he had to. All the publicity was out and the advance sale, and Vaughn insisted that he go through with it. But his stomach's been upset all afternoon, and he feels wretched. And, well, if the opening could only have been postponed a couple of days, I know Vaughn could do a splendid job.
My dear Mrs. Courtney, this is no concern of mine.
Yes, I realize that. But, Mr. Todd, if you could just mention something in your review, just a sentence, explaining that Vaughn felt so wretched and had a temper...
Mrs. Courtney, I'm about to proceed to my favorite bar and write a review. I have no intention of turning it into a medical report. It's a matter of supreme indifference to me whether your husband is suffering from chilblains, hydrophobia, galloping consumption, or barber's itch. He's giving an outrageously bad performance of a magnificent role... And I fully intend to say so. Good night.
No, please, Mr. Todd, you don't understand what this production means to him. It's not just a publicity stunt. In spite of what people think, Vaughn feels very deeply about acting. He's been studying and planning this night for years. It's terribly important to him. Well, if you were an actor, you'd understand. Now, Mr. Todd, couldn't you possibly come again tomorrow night or the night after? I know you'd feel that Vaughn was
Mrs.
wonderful.
Mrs. Courtney, I have a deadline to meet. You'll have to excuse me. A theater lobby is no place to stage a sob scene, so if you don't mind...
I should have known better. Good night, Mr. Todd.
Evening, Mr. Todd.
Evening, Gus.
I thought you were covering Macbeth tonight.
One act was as much as I could stand.
Not so hard, huh? Well, what'll it be? Same as usual?
Please. No, better make it a double.
Double it is.
I beg your pardon, sir, but you're Benson Todd, aren't you?
Yes, why?
I thought so. I wasn't quite sure.
Well, now you are.
Yes. I hope you don't mind my butting in like this, but my name is Edgar Fish.
You have my sympathy.
Thank you. I mean, yes. Mr. Todd, I've just been reading your new book. You know, Criteria.
I seem to recall it.
I just want to say how much I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think it's the best book on the American theater that I've ever read.
Really?
Oh, yes. I read through it twice.
Didn't you understand it the first time?
What? Oh, yes, I understood it all right. Although there were one or two points where I didn't quite see eye to eye with you.
You don't say?
Yes. For instance, in your chapter on the catharsis of comedy, you said that Shakespeare's idea of comedy is insulting to a modern intelligence.
Did I?
Oh, yes, very pointedly. Don't you remember? Of course, I'll grant you that the values of comedy are transient, but the basic elements of comedy haven't changed. Well, that's why I feel it.
My dear young man.
Yes?
Oh, nothing, never mind. Gus, take my check out of this, will you?
Yes, sir.
Oh, Mr. Todd, you're not leaving, are you?
I am indeed.
But I wanted to ask your opinion
I
about
never this. Express opinions unless I'm paid for
but
them.
But, Mr. Todd, you...
Thank you. Good night, Gus.
Good night, sir.
But, Mr. Todd,
Look,
you...
young man, the fact that you happen to have read one of my books does not constitute an introduction, though does it entitle you to bore the pants off me. Good night.
Hello, Store Club. This is Marcia Robbins of the Morning Chronicle speaking. Can you tell me Mr. Todd's there? No. Todd. Benson Todd. That's right. Well, would you find out, please? It's very important. Yes, I'll hold on. Oh, come in.
Hi, beautiful.
Oh, it's you, Jerry.
In the flesh, my sprite, in the flesh.
Well, take your flesh somewhere else. I'm busy.
Oh, come now. Is that any way to welcome the man you love?
Please, Jerry, I'm in no mood for fun and games.
What's the matter?
Plenty. We go to press early tonight.
Well, so what?
So, I haven't got Mr. Todd's copy yet.
Why not?
Because he hasn't come in yet, you dope.
Okay. Don't have to bite my head off.
Well, don't ask me stupid questions.
I'm not asking stupid questions.
Quiet. Hello? Yes. He isn't. Well, has he a reservation? I see. Well, look, if he comes in during the next few minutes, would you ask him to call his office? Yes, please, as soon as he comes in. Thanks very much. Good night.
What's the matter? Has the critical mind gone on the bat again?
I don't know, but wherever he's gone, he's certainly hidden his tracks.
Well, if he's covering a play, he could have gone to sleep. It's happened before.
I know, but I've checked the theater. He left at the end of the first act.
Wouldn't you know?
And I'm hanged if I can find out where he went.
Is there a bar near the theater?
I've tried every brass rail in the 40s.
How about the 50s?
Well, that's what I'm doing now. What's El Morocco's number?
How would I know? I'm a reporter, not a columnist.
Well, look it up for me, will you? I'm going to try his apartment again.
Wait a minute.
Jerry, please, I've got to find him.
I know, but listen, if he's left his review till this late, he'll most likely phone it in, won't he?
Well, he doesn't usually.
No, but if he does and you're on the wire all the time, how's he going to get it through?
But supposing he's forgotten all about the early deadline?
Supposing he has. It's not your fault.
Oh, isn't it? You don't know Benson Todd.
Well, what does it matter anyway? It's just another drama review.
My dear Jerry, that's the whole point. This isn't just another drama review. Tonight, it's news.
How come?
Good Lord, don't you read the papers? Vaughn Courtney opens in Macbeth tonight.
So what?
So what? So everything. Headlines, Klieg lights, fanfares, autographs. Hollywood in tights. Grammar boy brings bard to Broadway. Why, to read the publicity, you'd think Vaughn Courtney wrote Macbeth.
I'll bet Benson Todd is burning.
Is he ever? A Hollywood movie hero daring to appear on the New York stage in Shakespeare, you can imagine.
What does he say about it?
Oh, something to the effect that if Macbeth were never a tragedy before, it most certainly would be tonight.
Is that all? Oh, he can do better than that.
I think he's saving the barrage for his review.
It should make rather spirited reading.
If he ever gets here to write it. What's the time now?
Oh, relax. He'll turn up.
Well, he'd better. That's all I can say. He's in bad enough with the front office now. If he misses this deadline, I hate to think what'll happen.
Good evening, Mr. Todd.
Hello, Johnson. Got a table?
Yes, sir. How many are there?
Just myself.
How would you like the corner in the bar?
Good.
This way, sir. Will this one do, sir?
Perfectly.
Oh, by the way, sir, your office telephoned. Miss Robbins. She seemed very anxious to get in touch with you. Shall I have an extension connected?
No, thanks. I'll see about it later. Just bring me a double scotch with very little ice and very little water.
Very good, sir.
Make it two, John.
Huh? Oh, hello, Wendy.
Hello. Mind if I join you?
Not at all. Two, Johnson.
Yes, sir.
Well, glad to see me?
Should I be?
I'm not quite sure. I haven't seen much of you lately.
No, I've been rather busy.
Too busy to phone?
Now, look, Wendy, if you're going to stop
complaining... All right, I'm sorry. How did the opening go?
Which one?
Well, tonight. Macbeth, wasn't it?
So they tell me.
I'd love to see it.
I can't imagine why.
Well, I've never seen Vaughn Courtney except on the screen.
I should have thought that was more than sufficient.
But I've always liked him in pictures.
Je connais son goût.
What?
It's French, Wendy. It means everyone to his own taste.
You're terribly hard to please, aren't you? By the way, Friedman's new show goes into rehearsal on Monday.
Yes, I know.
I went round to his office yesterday.
Well, any luck?
Well, no, I couldn't get in to see him. They said they'd never heard of me.
Should they have?
Well, yes, after all, you said you'd fix it for me.
I said what?
You said you'd fix it for me, about getting a part, I mean.
My dear girl, I did nothing of the sort.
But of course you did, don't you remember? You promised. But you can't go
now,
back on...
Now, just a minute, Wendy. I take it you feel I'm under some sort of obligation to you, is that it?
Well, no, not exactly. But you did say you'd speak to Friedman.
You seem to forget that I'm a drama critic, not an actor's agent.
But, Benson, you said that you...
My function is reviewing the stage, not peppering it with aspiring ingenues from Minnesota.
But you promised...
If you take my advice, Wendy, you'll just forget the whole incident.
I see.
Here, have a cigarette.
No, thank you.
Oh, go on, have one.
I don't want one.
Very well.
I don't want anything from
except
you.
Except a part in Friedman's show.
That's a pretty rotten thing to say.
But true. By the way, why don't you try your wiles on Friedman?
I wouldn't have believed you could be so completely callous.
You'll have to work fast, though. He goes into rehearsal on Monday, remember?
I won't be here on Monday.
Oh? Going somewhere?
Yes.
Where, Minnesota?
Does it matter?
Not especially.
I didn't think so.
Well, have a nice trip.
Thank you. Well, I guess that's my exit cue.
You should know. You claim to be an actress.
Yes. Well, goodbye, Mr. Todd.
Goodbye, Wendy. Better luck next time.
Yeah, you are, sir.
Thank you, Johnson. I'll take them both.
Yes, sir. Isn't the young lady coming back?
I hardly think so, Johnson. I hardly think so.
Well, 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 if it isn't Fancy Boy Todd himself.
Hello, Max. How's the world's greatest producer?
Hmm. Why aren't you at the opening? When they let you in?
Unfortunately, yes.
Ah, walked out on it, huh?
One act was plenty.
You know, you got a lot of nerve, Todd.
So have you, judging by that last little stinker of yours.
Oh, yeah? Well, what makes you think you can review a show like Macbeth when you only see the first act, huh?
My dear Max, it isn't necessary to eat a whole egg to find out it's putrid.
Very funny. You ought to use that sometime.
I probably will. When is your next production?
What do you care? You won't get in to see it.
Uh-huh. Still licking your wounds, eh?
You can call it that if you like.
What's the matter, Max? Can't you take it anymore?
Sure, sure, I can take it if I have to, but I don't have to take the kind of schmo-wise cracks you hand out.
You don't say.
Yes, I do say. You know, you're going to wake up and find yourself looking for a new sheet one of these days, Todd, and you can take it from me. There are plenty of guys around town who'll make a point of seeing you don't find one.
I see. You know, Max, I believe I've been underrating you.
I'll say you have.
Yes. I've always maintained you couldn't possibly be as vulgar as one of your productions.
What?
Apparently, I was wrong.
Why, you dirty... Okay, Todd, you've asked for it once too often.
Where on earth do you suppose he can be?
Look, you've asked me that 14 times, and I still don't know the answer.
Well, he should have been here a half hour ago.
All right, but there's no need to get yourself into a dither about it. It won't be the first time he's missed a deadline.
No, but it may be the last. And if he gets the axe, I'll probably get it, too.
Good. Then you can marry me. We'll buy a nice little rose-covered cottage in Brooklyn and live happily ever after.
Oh, go to... Ah, there he is. Hello. Oh, no. No, he's not. Well, I couldn't say for sure. He's supposed to be here now. Is there any message? Well, who shall I say was calling? Hello? Hello? You know, that's funny. That's the third time she's phoned in the last hour.
Who?
I don't know, some woman.
Oh, what's so funny about it?
Nothing, only each time I ask her who's calling, she hangs up on me.
Very discreet, I'd say.
Just the same, I'd like to know what goes on.
Probably one of our critical colleagues' girlfriends. I'm told he leads a pretty shady love life.
I gather you don't altogether approve of our Mr. Todd.
You gather correctly. For my money, he's a grade-A jerk.
You'll have to admit he's a grade-A critic.
Nuts, he's a lousy critic.
Oh, who says so?
I say so.
Oh, and of course, that settles the matter.
No, not necessarily, but Well, I certainly can't have any use for a critic who despises the theater as much as Todd does.
Despises the theater? Whatever gave you that idea?
Well, isn't it obvious? He pans every play he sees.
Oh, come now.
Of course he does. I've never read a review of his yet that didn't flay the hide off the author or insult the actors or sneer at the producer.
Well, maybe they deserved it.
But that's not the point.
Well, what is the point?
Simply that a critic should be constructive, not destructive.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's true. A critic's job is to contribute something to the theater, not sit back and make cheap cracks at it. After all, it doesn't take any great brain to write the sort of stuff Todd does. Any fool can jeer.
Including yourself, I suppose.
Oh, for the love of Pete, the female mind.
What's that?
I said the female mind. Why is it that a woman can never discuss any subject for 3 minutes without making a personal issue of it?
For exactly the same reason that a man can never discuss any subject for 3 minutes without being patronizing about it.
Who's being patronizing?
You are.
I'm not being anything of the kind. I simply stated that a dramatic critic should be constructive and not destructive.
And I simply state that you don't know what you're talking about.
Now, who's being patronizing?
Oh, shut up.
I beg your pardon.
I said shut up.
Now, look here, Marget.
Oh, there's Mr. Todd. Quick, hand him a pencil.
Say, please.
Oh, all right, please. Come on, give it to me. Hello? What? No, it's not. Well, I haven't got it yet. Mr. Todd hasn't come in. I don't know. Well, all right, you don't have to yell at me. It's not my fault. Yes, I heard you. Okay, you'll get Todd's copy as soon as it's ready.
Who is that, Sloan?
Oh, yes, he's raising the roof. What'll I do?
Let him rave.
But, Jerry, he's not kidding. They're holding space. I've got to do something.
Well, I guess there's only one thing you can do.
What?
Write the review yourself.
Don't be funny.
No, I'm serious. If Sloan's yelling for copy and Todd's not here, somebody's got to write it.
Well, it won't be me, I can tell you that.
All right, I will.
What?
Get your pencil. I'll dictate a loop.
Now, just a minute. Not so fast.
Come on, there's no time to waste. Sloan's waiting.
But, Jerry, this is crazy.
Don't argue.
Jerry, we'll never get away
Why
with
not?
It.
Come on, come on. Make with the pencil.
Oh, okay, my impetuous young friend. But don't say I didn't warn you.
Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, now. Let's see. Where's it playing?
The Gotham.
Gotham, okay. Take this.
Mm.
Had the immortal bard been present at the Gotham Theater tonight, he would have... No, change that. Try this. It is perhaps...
Wait a minute. I think I've got it. The opening sentence. Listen. Shakespeare wrote Macbeth as a tragedy, but tonight on the stage of the Gotham Theater, it emerged as a comedy. How's that?
Brilliant.
Oh.
I wish I'd said it.
Oh, why, Mr. Todd, I didn't hear you come in.
Perhaps I should have knocked.
Well, I've been trying all over town to find you.
So I see.
I mean by telephone. I was afraid you'd forgotten the early deadline.
Very considerate.
Excuse me, Mr. Todd, Your mouth is bleeding.
I'm quite aware of that fact, thank you. And just what, may I ask, are you doing here?
Well, I was just helping Marcia. I mean, Miss Robbins. We thought if you didn't turn up, we might get your coffee ready.
Really? Well, when I require your services in this department, I'll let you know. In the meantime, I'll thank you to get out of my office and stay out of it.
Now, just a minute, Todd.
You heard me.
Yes, I heard
Jerry,
you.
Jerry, please.
Okay, I'm going. But someday this paper is going to get wise to you, too.
And close the door behind you.
Go to...
And now, Miss Robbins, if you have no objection, I should like to express my opinion of tonight's opening in my own words. Becomes entirely meaningless through the garbled mouthings and idiotic posturings of this presumptuous Hollywood heartthrob, period. See who the devil that is and tell him I'm out.
All right. Hello? Who's calling, please? Just a moment. It's Mrs. Vaughan Courtney. She seems rather upset.
Give me that phone.
Here you are.
Mrs. Courtney, you've already bothered me quite enough for one evening. Now, in the vernacular of the pool room, will you and your husband please go away somewhere and drop dead? Now, where was I?
Idiotic posturings of this presumptuous Hollywood heartthrob.
Ah, yes. In fact, Mr. Vaughan Courtney's Macbeth is unquestionably the worst performance of that role it has ever been my misfortune to witness on any professional stage, either here or abroad.
In fact, Mr. Vaughan Courtney's Macbeth is unquestionably the worst performance of that role it has ever been my misfortune to witness on any professional stage, either here or abroad. My gosh, Masha, how can he write that stuff?
Well, I shouldn't think you'd be bothered reading it after the way he kicked you out of the office tonight.
Yeah, that twerp. Still, I've got to admit, the guy does have style. Just listen to this. Here. In the second soliloquy, Macbeth appeared to be coping not so much with the pangs of an uneasy conscience as with the twinges of a faulty intestine. Yipe.
Oh, please, Jerry, I've heard it once tonight, and I don't think it's either clever or amusing.
Say, what's the matter with you, anyway?
Oh, nothing, just tired, I guess.
Yeah, it is kind of late. Wonder if the other papers are out yet.
Should be by now, why?
Well, I'd like to see what the other critics say. Hey, Louie.
Yeah?
Got any morning papers there?
Yeah, I got a news. Just came in.
Let's see it, will you?
Yeah, sure.
Want some more coffee, honey?
No, thanks.
Hey, that's too bad about that movie guy, huh?
What movie guy?
It's here on the front page. See?
Actor dies on stage.
What's that? Who?
Vaughn Courtney.
You're kidding.
No, look.
Vaughn Courtney, Hollywood film star, died tonight in the stage wings of the Gotham City. Oh, no.
That's too bad, huh? His appendix busted.
Appendix?
Yeah. It says, stricken with acute appendicitis during the first performance of Macbeth, the idol of movie-going millions collapsed before a horrified first-night audience and was carried from the stage by members of his company.
Holy Peter, when did it happen?
Right in the middle of the show, during the third act.
Oh, brother, this is the payoff. Todd's really done it this time. He wasn't even there.
Holy cat, but he reviewed the whole show.
Exactly.
Oh, my aching back. Will this raise a stink? Wait till the chief reads that bit about the faulty intestine.
Wait till he reads the last paragraph.
Why, what does that say?
Read it yourself.
All right. Since the text has been so obviously mutilated to veil the star's shortcomings as an actor, we can only regret that they didn't follow through. Why prolong Macbeth's demise for 5 acts? Mr. Courtney would have done us all a great favor had he arranged to meet his maker in the middle of the second.
See what I mean?
Holy suffering cow.
Well, that's the story. Not exactly an edifying tale, but I think if you scratch between the lines a bit, you'll detect a certain moral tinge. At any rate, if I ever get around to writing that book about Benson Todd, I'll certainly include it. However, the likelihood of that is rather slim, I'm afraid. For one thing, Jerry threatens to divorce me unless I spend a little more time with him. And for another, well, being the new dramatic critic for the Chronicle keeps me pretty darn busy these nights, believe me.
You have just heard Deadline, Attraction 27 on Radio City Playhouse. Deadline was written by John Bethune, and the production was directed by Harry W. Junkin. Claudia Morgan played Marcia Robbins. Paul Nugent was Benson Todd. Bernard Grant was Jerry. Other members of the cast included Charlotte Holland, Marilyn Erskine, Bob Dryden, Eugene Francis, and Steve Gethers. The music was composed and conducted by Dr. Roy Shield. Radio City Playhouse is supervised for the National Broadcasting Company by Richard P. McDonough.
This is Harry Junkin again. Next week, a radical and complete departure from our regular format. We're sure you'll be charmed and delighted with Two Moods from the Past, a type of radio entertainment we have never attempted on Radio City Playhouse. Next week as Attraction 28. Good night, everybody.
This program came to you from New York. Bob Warren speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Truth is stranger than fiction. This is the truth. This is Ripley. Believe it or not. If you were to subtract 40 from the number of cricket chirps a minute and divide the result by 4, then add 50 to that result, you would be able to tell the temperature without a thermometer. Believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about the strange heritage of our railroads. Practically the entire civilized world now uses the standard railroad gauge of 4 feet 8.5 inches. This width was used by the Roman chariots with which Julius Caesar's army invaded Britain in 55 B.C. They were copied by the native Celts, with the result that deep ruts of that width were worn on English roads in the course of centuries. Today, more than 2,000 years after Caesar's invasion, modern vehicles roll on these indelible chariot tracks. Believe it or not.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio, with a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But there are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and as interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you, the human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now, presenting a man whose name, since the beginning of broadcasting, has been a byword in radio, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gil Martin, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. This afternoon, Behind the Mic presents the story of how a radio character actor does his stuff, how sound effects are made, the odd story behind the time an announcer was supposed to broadcast from the famous Coconut Grove in Hollywood. We bring you back a few moments of the old Atwater Kent program. And finally, there will be a dramatization of a remarkable story told by Jimmy Wallington. You wouldn't be a radio listener if you didn't wonder every once in a while how those sound effects you hear on programs are made. The sound of a taxi, a shotgun, a train wreck, and all the rest of the noises that are necessary to a script. We have two of the best sound effects men in the business here tonight, and they will demonstrate various sound effects and tell you how they're made. Ted Slade will do the actual effects, and Ray Kelly, head of the NBC Sound Effects Department, will explain how each effect is done. Now Ted, our sound man, has his equipment set up next to a microphone. And I'm going to tell a rather crazy story, which will use many sound effects, and Ray Kelly will explain how each effect was made. Our story begins with our hero's train pulling into the railroad station.
Ladies and gentlemen, that sound was created by using 4 records, each on a different turntable and all operated by Ted Slade.
Our hero goes to his home and walks up the snow-covered path.
That sound is produced by taking a box of cornstarch and squeezing it in the same rhythm in which a person would walk.
Our hero opens his door.
And that, believe it or not, is a door.
He discovers a burglar, and they have a terrific fight.
And that was accomplished by Ted Slade, the sound man, engaging in a civil war. He punched the open palm of his hand with his fist, he hit himself on the chest, threw several chairs around, broke some fruit baskets, and finally smashed some glass in front of the microphone.
You should have seen that boy beat himself up. Well, our hero now tries to phone the police, but his telephone wires have been cut. So he ties up the burglar and takes him to the police station in his old horse and wagon.
That wagon is a box mounted on casters, which the sound effects man wiggles with his foot. Ted impersonated the horse by taking two rubber plungers and hitting them on his chest. Both the caster box and the plungers are worked simultaneously.
Our hero takes the burglar to jail, where he is safely locked up.
And that sound was done by closing a specially built door constructed exactly like a cell door.
How do you know?
You don't get me on that one. I saw the specification.
And then to give the scene a punch ending and still another sound effect, our hero, wearily enough, feeling pleased with himself, decides to go for a row on the lake.
A lap of the water is created by using a splash box. This is a tank of water with a paddle in it, which is turned slowly to produce the sound of rowing. The squeak of the oar lock was made by using a squeak box, a little gadget that's too complicated to explain here.
And as the moon rises, we leave our hero rowing to his heart's content. Equally pleased that he has captured the burglar and that he has made his first and last appearance on a radio program. Those of you who listen to our program regularly will remember that we have had as guests on Behind the Mic two of the best comedy character actors in radio. Tonight, we have as a guest a different type of actor, a legitimate character actor, a man who plays a large number of different roles, mostly on dramatic shows. He has appeared in Arch Obler's plays, on the Kate Smith Show, and in a great many daytime serials. Tonight, we'd like you to meet him in person. Introducing character actor Gilbert Mack. Gil, what background have you got for character acting?
Well, Graham, I played in stock and I sang in vaudeville and I was even a hillbilly yodeler. As a matter of fact, I broke into radio as a yodeler.
Don't tell me that being a Mountain William helped you to become a radio actor.
Well, as a matter of fact, Graham, I think it did. I'm sure that the flexibility of my voice was helped by my yodeling. I believe that one of the reasons I can play so many characters is because my vocal cords are so elastic.
Oh, so your vocal cords are elastic. You must come around and snap them for us sometime. Well, now that we've got your background stuff, how about showing us some of the characters you actually portray on the air?
All right, Graham. I'll do that in a little sketch in which I'm going to play all the parts.
The scene is the home of the rich Mr. Brownlee. In the spacious living room, a group of people are gathered listening to Mr. Brownlee.
So if you will tell me exactly what you heard and saw last night, we may be able to find some trace of that missing necklace.
Gee, Dad, I was in my room all night.
We're sure of that, Tommy. But did you hear any strange noise?
Well, Grandpa, I got so interested in my ghost story magazine.
Uh-huh. Ghost stories. That ain't for me. I just...
Quiet, Sam. We'll get nowhere unless we stick to facts.
Mr. Brownlee's right, Sam. Suppose we hear from our houseboy, Sato.
Oh, thank you, sir. Last night, about 3 o'clock, I was suddenly aware of presence of strange gentleman in bedchamber. Then saw a gentleman putting Sito back to sleep with well placed tap on head.
And when you awoke this morning, the necklace was gone from the wall safe.
Gee, Dad, this looks like a case for the G-men. Say, look at that car pulling up outside.
Oh. Say, I wonder who that man coming in there, huh? Yes, and who's that little fella he's dragging along there with him?
Well, I'm Detective Mannigan from headquarters, and I've brought along a suspect. I found him snooping around outside the house.
Why, I know that man. He's Tony, our vegetable dealer.
That's right. I'm just a poor man. I'm selling fruits and vegetables. I'm do nothing, and he said to me I'm a crook.
Doing nothing, is it? Well, then, how come this pearl necklace I found in your pocket?
Yes, sir, that's the jewelry.
Please, Mr. Cop, I'm going to tell you just what happened. When I come here before I ring the bell, Sato, he's opened up the door and pushing his junk in my hand. What am I going to do, eh? So I'm going to hang around and wait when you come along and pull me inside. That's all.
So, Sato gave you that necklace, eh?
Oh, please, sir. Is this a serious mistake?
Never mind the alibis. Come clean or I'll take you down to the station house for questioning.
Oh, please, sir. I am willing to tell the truth if you'll promise not to give me no third-degree copper.
Gee, Dad, Sato lost his accent.
That's right. Sato isn't quite what we thought he was.
Well, I thought I could get away with this disguise till I pulled this job off, but I guess it didn't work out.
But Sato, or whatever your real name is, where did you learn such a neat trick?
That was a cinch. After all, I did a 10-year stretch up in a big house, and I was a star performer every year in the annual show. And it looks like you're going back for return engagement.
Folks, Gilbert Mack not only played every character, but he also made the sound effects of the scream of the automobile brakes.
With my own elastic vocal cords.
And you sure did snap them that time. Thank you, Gilbert Mack. Thank you. Oddities in Radio. Presenting odd little true behind-the-mic stories that help make radio sometimes amusing, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting to the people in it. This week's oddity. One of NBC's prominent young announcers is Don Cordray, who appeared on this program a few weeks ago in an interview. Don has an unusual story of, an amusing experience, which we thought merited his reappearance. Don, suppose you tell us your story.
All right, Graham. It's going to take us back a few years, but I was an announcer at KFI in Los Angeles. At the time, my burning ambition was to broadcast from the Coconut Grove, where Gus Arnheim was playing at that time.
Why was that such an ambition?
Well, Graham, it may sound silly, but because the Coconut Grove meant getting a chance to meet those movie stars and be seen by them. For a whole year, I ate out my heart and soul just to do one broadcast on a Saturday night for a full hour from Coconut Grove. Well, on a Friday, the chief announcer, Tom Hanlon, called me into his office and said that Freeman Lang, the regular announcer of the Coconut Grove, was ill. I was to fill in for him on that Saturday. Well, Graham, believe it or not, I was so excited at the thought of doing that broadcast, I went out and hired a full dress suit for $12.50. The next night, I was at Coconut Grove, but mind you, plenty early. I saw the engineer as I entered the Grove, and he called me when he saw me come in and said,
Hey, Don, what you doing here so early?
Well, I don't know, Paul, just sort of looking around. Boy, this is some place, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Don, as long as you aren't doing anything, I wonder if you'd help me out. See that microphone tied up against the wall?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's hanging from the ceiling, and I'm going to untie it so that it'll swing over the center of the stage. Will you catch it for me?
Oh, sure thing.
I'll be careful when it swings over. It's heavy.
Okay.
Here she goes.
Hey, Don.
Who's that? Why, Charlie, what are you...
Hey, look out. It's going to hit you.
Oh!
Come here. Stand back. Up. Come on, give him some air there. Step aside, will you?
Doctor, he's got to do a broadcast tonight.
Broadcast? Not this boy. When that mic hit his head, it knocked him out for the evening.
And I was knocked out, Graham. They called for another announcer. I think it was Ken Carpenter. I never got a chance to broadcast from Coconut Grove.
You poor guy. Socked on the coconut by the coconut. Behind the Mic salutes a program you loved. We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud. A tradition of good programs that linger fondly in our memory. And so each week, we bring you a star or a part of a program you used to hear. A program you loved. This afternoon, Behind the Mic salutes the old Atwater Kent Hour, which with its national auditions was designed to select the best non-professional singers in the country each year. We recreate part of the Atwater Kent auditions of December 11th, 1927, with the actual winner of the first national competition, the delightful concert soprano Agnes Davis. The Atwater Kent Hour. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. Tonight, Atwater Kent presents the finals of what is probably the most important musical competition ever attempted in the United States. Every singer in the United States under 25 years of age has had an opportunity to be heard. By the process of elimination in local auditions, the contestants have been reduced to 5 young women and 5 young men who have qualified for the national finals. They will sing tonight in the final competition. The Atwater Kent Foundation will award the young woman and young man winning first place $5,000 cash, a gold decoration, and 2 years of musical tuition. The winners of this contest will be selected by a jury of 9 eminent musical authorities. Each singer will be announced by name. The first singer is Miss Mary Sims, who will sing the Caronome. Here, Miss Marie Bronazic of Chicago, who will sing A Forse Lui from Traviata. Our next contestant, Benjamin P. DeLoach, Jr., will sing Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes. As the last of the 10 contestants, Miss Agnes Davis of Denver will sing Pace, Pace, Mio Dio by Verdi.
What?
Ladies and gentlemen, the contest which means so much to young singers who traveled so far to take part in the finals of the nationwide search for America's finest and most promising young artists, sponsored by the Atwater Kent Foundation, is ended. The judge's decision will be announced within the next hour, we hope, by the station through which you are listening. This is Graham McNamee saying good evening for the Atwater Kent Hour. An hour later, when the judges had made their decision, I was happy to announce over the air that Miss Agnes Davis had been adjudged the winner of the first prize for young women singers, $5,000, a 2-year musical scholarship, and a gold medal. Today, Miss Davis, who has appeared as soloist with the leading symphony orchestras throughout the United States, is rated as one of the best concert artists in the country. And as an old friend, Agnes, let me add that after Pache Pache, we need no further proof. Letters from listeners. Each week we invite the listeners of Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio, and the three or four we consider to be of most general interest, we have answered on the air by the radio editor of some outstanding newspaper or magazine. Tonight's questions will be answered by C.J. Ingram, radio editor of the Jersey City Journal, and for 10 years, conductor of his own program, Stardust. Miss Thelma Reed of Boston, Massachusetts, writes in to say, I am a constant listener to Bob Burns' program. I read somewhere that Bob Burns was an expert rifle shot. Is this true, or is it just publicity?
Well, for Miss Reed's information, Bob Burns is really a crack shot. As a matter of fact, he was rifle champion of the AEF and got a gold medal signifying his championship, a medal which was pinned on him by General Pershing himself.
Miss Rose Farrell of Mount Pleasant, Pennsylvania, writes in to ask, since radio is now celebrating its 20th year of broadcasting, can you tell me what was the very first broadcast and what were the call letters of the station that gave the program?
Well, we find there are two schools of thought as to which was the first station to broadcast a regularly scheduled program. The majority of persons in radio seem to think that KDKA in Pittsburgh was the first station to broadcast, and its program was the Harding Cox Election Returns, broadcast November the 2nd, 1920. However, there are some who claim that station WWJ of Detroit broadcast the first regularly scheduled program on August 21st, 1920, when it broadcast the returns of the state primaries.
Miss Marjorie Miller of Birmingham, Alabama writes, I am a frequent listener to the broadcast from the Metropolitan Opera. Can you tell me when was the first broadcast from the Metropolitan Opera House?
In answer to Miss Miller's question, the first broadcast from the Metropolitan was on January 13th, 1910. When experimental station operated by the DeForest radiophone broadcast the voice of the great Enrico Caruso and Emmy Destin from backstage. The broadcast was picked up at sea by the steamship Avon.
Miss Martha Burnett of New York City asked this question. Can you tell me what was the first program ever to appear on a network?
The first program ever to appear on a network was that given by the Sweethearts of the Air, Peter DeRose and May Singy Breen, on a network consisting of WRC Washington and WEAF New York City. And the broadcast originated in Washington.
Thank you, C.J. Ingram, for answering those questions for us. Thanks a lot. or so ago, I was having lunch with a man whose voice must have been heard by every radio listener in the last 10 years. He's been an important cog in many big programs. And right now, he's the announcer on the new Fred Allen Show. Yes, of course, I mean Jimmy Wallington. Jimmy told me a behind-the-mic story I thought was so good and so unusual that I invited him to come here this afternoon to tell you about it. And here he is to do that very thing. But first, I want to welcome him back to the East. Jimmy Wallington. Hello, Jimmy. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Graham. And believe me, it's good to be back with you and my other good friends in New York City. The story starts back in the early 1920s. The scene was the Mojave Desert, way out west in California. An auto was speeding along the dusty highway, and there was a good reason for it to speed, too. In the back seat were a husband and his wife. The wife, in agony, had suddenly been stricken with an attack of acute appendicitis. Their friend, the driver, was getting every last ounce of speed he could from the car in an effort to reach a doctor in the town of Mojave as quickly as possible, when suddenly...
What's the matter?
I don't know. Must be something wrong with the engine. I'll take a look at it.
How are you, dear?
It's pretty bad.
Well, don't worry. We'll get you to a doctor just as soon as we possibly can.
Oh, this is awful. We're out of oil and one of the bearings is shot.
Well, can you fix it?
I'm not here. I'd have to hail a car, explain the situation, and ask them to take her to a doctor. They can't refuse.
Oh, here's one now.
Hey! Hey, stop! 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 I'll try the next one.
This is terrible.
Darling, if there was something I could do... Here comes another one.
Hey, stop! 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 We've had an accident!
Oh, why don't they stop?
I don't know. Maybe they're afraid we're going to hold them up or something. I think there was a holdup along here not long ago.
But we've got to get her to a doctor.
There hasn't been a car along here for half an hour. Well, here's one. This one's got to stop. Stop! Hey, stop! Stop!
What's the matter?
This lady is sick. We've got to get her to the doctor at Mojave as fast as we can.
We'll be glad to take them, won't we, Dad?
Why, sure thing, son. Come on, get in back, folks, and I'll have you there in a jiffy.
The scene now changes to an Atwater Kent program in 1928. Although you did the actual program announcing Graham, as you know, I also worked on that program. On one Atwater Kent program each year, as you've shown tonight, 10 candidates for musical scholarships and large cash prizes would compete, and some of the foremost people in the musical world would act as judges to select the winner. And also, as you know, the judges did not see the contestants while they were singing, so they could judge them by the voice alone. Contestants and judges met for the first time after the program, when a little party would be held in an adjoining studio. And after this particular program, the evening's winner approached one of the judges who had awarded him the first prize of $5,000.
Oh, pardon me, sir, but may I speak to you a moment?
Why, certainly. I want to congratulate you, young man. You did splendidly.
Oh, thank you, sir. But I want to ask you something. Do you remember a long time ago when you were driving a lady to the doctor and your car broke down in the Mojave Desert? A man came along with his son, and they took you to the doctor in their car?
Well, yes, I remember that vividly. Do you mean...
Yes, sir. I was the boy.
Why, of course, now I remember. The father's name was Novus, and you're Donald Novus, his son. This is remarkable.
Yes, sir. But even more remarkable to me is that tonight, for the first time, I should find out that the man we helped was the great Lawrence Tibbet.
Thank you for bringing us a very great story, Jimmy Wallington. Thanks a lot. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions about the inside of radio that you wish answered on the air, write a letter to us. Address it to Graham McNamee, Behind the Mic, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. As many questions as possible will be answered by mail, and those we feel to be of most general interest will be answered on this program. Be sure to listen in next week when we will bring you one of the funniest, most fantastic behind-the-mic stories you ever heard. A story behind Dave Ellman's Hobby Lobby program, as told by Dave Ellman himself. We will also bring you the story of a man who makes a living dying on the radio, and more of the human interest, the glamour, the comedy and the drama that are found behind the mic.
Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis, original music composed and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
That's going to do it for the Relic Radio Show for this week. I'll be back next Tuesday with another hour of old-time radio. But between now and then, there's more old-time radio coming to RelicRadio.com. Visit the site. You'll find past episodes, all the other shows, and links to everything else Relic Radio. There's also a donate button there. If you'd like to help support this and all the shows, help keep it all going, certainly appreciate it if you're able to help out. Thank you, as always, to those who have. And thank you for joining me today. Be back next Tuesday with another episode of the Relic Radio Show.